2 Samuel 2, starting at verse 12. Abner, the son of Ner, and the servants of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David, went out and met them at the pool of Gibeon. And they sat down, one on one side of the pool, and the other on the other side of the pool. And Abner said to Joab, "Let the young men arise and compete before us." And Joab said, "Let them arise." And they arose and passed over by number, 12 from Benjamin and Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. And each caught his opponent by the head and thrust his sword in his opponent's side. So they fell down together. Therefore the place was called Helkath Hazurim, which is at Gibeon. And the battle was very fierce that day, and Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. And the three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. Now Asahel was as swift of foot as a wild gazelle. And Asahel pursued Abner, and as he went, he turned neither to the right hand nor to the left from following Abner. Then Abner looked behind him and said, "Is it you, Asahel?" And he answered, "It is I." Abner said to him, "Turn aside to your right hand or to your left, and seize one of the young men and take his spoil." But Asahel would not turn aside from following him. And Abner said again to Asahel, "Turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then could I lift up my face to your brother Joab?" But he refused to turn aside. Therefore Abner struck him in the stomach with the butt of his spear, so that the spear came out his back, and he fell there and died where he was. And all who came to the place where Asahel had fallen and died stood still. But Joab and Abishai pursued Abner. And as the sun was going down, they came to the hill of Ammah, which lies before Gia, on the way of the wilderness to Gibeon. And the people of Benjamin gathered themselves together behind Abner and became one group and took their stand on the top of a hill. And Abner called to Joab, "Shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know that the end will be bitter? How long will it be before you tell your people to turn from the pursuit of their brothers?" And Joab said, "As God lives, if you had not spoken, surely the men would not have given up the pursuit of their brothers until the morning." So Joab blew the trumpet, and all the men stopped and pursued Israel no more, nor did they fight any more. And Abner and his men went all that night through the Arabah. They crossed the Jordan, and marching the whole morning, they came to Mahanaim. Joab returned from the pursuit of Abner, and when he had gathered all the people together, there were missing from David's servants 19 besides Asahel. But the servants of David had struck down of Benjamin 360 of Abner's men. And they took up Asahel and buried him in the tomb of his father, which was at Bethlehem. And Joab and his men marched all night, and the day broke upon them at Hebron. There was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David, and David grew stronger and stronger, while the house of Saul became weaker and weaker. And sons were born to David at Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon of Anahoam of Jezreel, and his second, Kileb of Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel, and the third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Gersha. And the fourth, Adonijah, the son of Haggith. And the fifth, Shephatiah, the son of Abita. And the sixth, Ithream of Eglah, David's wife. These were born to David in Hebron. While there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul. Now Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ish-bosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone into my father's concubine?" Then Abner was very angry over the words of Ishbosheth and said, "Am I a dog's head of Judah? To this day I keep showing steadfast love to the house of Saul your father, to his brothers and to his friends, and have not given you into the hand of David. And yet you charge me today with a fault concerning a woman. God do so to Abner and more also, if I do not accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah, from Dan to Beersheba." And Ishbosheth could not answer Abner another word, because he feared him. And Abner sent messengers to David on his behalf, saying, "To whom does the land belong? Make your covenant with me, and behold, my hand shall be with you, to bring over all Israel to you." And he said, "Good, I will make a covenant with you, but one thing I require of you, that is, you shall not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face." Then David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, saying, "Give my wife Michal, for whom I paid the bridal price of 100 foreskins of the Philistines." And Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband Paltiel, the son of Laish. But her husband went with her, weeping after her all the way to Bahurim. Then Abner said to him, "Go, return." And he returned. And Abner conferred with the elders of Israel, saying, "For some time past you have been seeking David as king over you. Now then, bring it about. For the Lord has promised David, saying, 'By the hand of my servant David, I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies.'" Abner also spoke to Benjamin, and then Abner went to tell David at Hebron all that Israel and the whole house of Benjamin thought good to do. Then Abner came with 20 men to David at Hebron. David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. And Abner said to David, "I will arise and go and will gather all Israel to my lord the king, and they may make a covenant with you, and that you may reign over all that your heart desires." So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. Just then the servants of David arrived with Joab from a raid, bringing much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David at Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. When Joab and all the army that was with him came, it was told Joab, "Abner, the son of Ner, came to the king, and he has let him go, and he has gone in peace." Then Joab went to the king and said, "What have you done? Behold, Abner came to you. Why is it that you have sent him away so that he is gone? You know that Abner, the son of Ner, came to deceive you, and to know your going out and your coming in, and to know all that you are doing." When Joab came out of David's presence, he sent messengers after Abner, and they brought him back to the cistern of Sirah. But David did not know about it. And when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside into the midst of the gate to speak with him privately, and there he struck him in the stomach, so that he died, for the blood of Asahel, his brother. Afterwards, when David heard of it, he said, "I and my kingdom are forever guiltless before the Lord for the blood of Abner the son of Ner. May it fall upon the head of Joab and upon all his father's house. And may the house of Joab never be without one who has a discharge or who is leprous, or who holds a spindle or falls by the sword, or who lacks bread." So Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner, because he had put their brother Asahel to death in the battle of Gibeon. Then David said to Joab and all the peoples who were with him, "Tear your clothes and put on sackcloth and mourn before Abner." And King David followed the bier. They burned Abner at Hebron, and the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept. And the king lamented for Abner, saying, "Should Abner die as a fool dies? Your hands were not bound, your feet were not fettered. As one falls before the wicked, you have fallen." And all the people wept again over him. Then all the people came to persuade David to eat bread while it was yet day. But David swore, saying, God do to me and more also, if I taste bread or anything else, till the sun goes down. And all the people took notice of it, and it pleased them, as everything that the king did pleased all the people. So all the people and all Israel stood that day, that it had not been the king's will to put to death Abner the son of Ner. And the king said to his servants, Do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? And I was gentle today, though anointed king. These men are the sons of Zeruiah, are more severe than I. The Lord repay the evildoer according to his wickedness. Well, I'm guessing some of you at this point will be experiencing some form of frustration to do with politics. So there's an array of political views, but what tends to happen with all those views that are out there is they fall into two sides. And both oppose each other, regardless of what's said. It could be that they know that one of them is right, but they have to oppose. And their only concern is winning. Their concern is not the good of the nation. There is no way, it's not conceivable, that they could come together over a common purpose. There's no point of a chance of a compromise or a back down. And that's a bit worse than that, because within those political parties, there are divisions. They don't want the best for their own party, for their own side, far less the nation. Everyone seems to want to lead that side in order to therefore go and lead the nation, or at least keep the current leader but have control over that current leader. So the leader stays, but we all know who's really running the show. And even though such divisions weaken your own side, making ruling the nation, therefore being leader of it, even less likely, and making the nation therefore weaker in the whole international setting and how other countries view them. Such is the frustration we now find ourselves in 2 Samuel chapter 2 and 3, in 10th century BC Israel. Any comparisons to the UK and Brexit are coincidental. And it's relevant not because of Brexit. Actually, we're thinking about this is near, but that's far away, that we thought about this morning. If you read the news, it goes on, obviously, in the US. It's going on at the moment in Brazil and in Europe. That people are more concerned about their own place in a party than how well the party does, and more concerned about how the party does than how the nation does. And it's true of everybody. That's not a politically weighted comment, is it? That's true across. But perhaps this part of the Bible explains why. But the reason why it's relevant to you and to me is because this same thing happens in the church. So this passage is a warning and an encouragement. Most passages are, but particularly this gives big warnings, big encouragements. The warning is that churches and Christians are full of self-interest. And that divisions in churches and between Christians are not always bad and not always avoidable. Think of the Reformation, although it was a reformation. It wasn't a let's go back to the kitchen and start again. The idea was it was to reform the church. But nonetheless, the divisions there were unavoidable and have brought something good. But not all divisions are about doctrine and our conscience. Often, the sort of, oh, I think you're doing that bit, not as the Bible says, comes later, and it's looked for to justify the divisions that have already happened. Maybe it's just me, but I think other people notice that Christians have an ability far beyond anyone else I know to reinvent the wheel. So they do a conference on something that 20 other people are already doing conferences on, or whatever it is. And why does that happen? Because we want it to be our will, so we can steer it. So mission agencies converge on the same town and do their own conferences and so on and claim to be the only people reaching the lost in that nation, but they're just reshuffling the sheep in a particular town whilst leaving the rest of the country untouched. Churches do similar things, often very similar churches plant next to each other, often literally. I can think of a town where I think the walls actually touch of where a new plant went, so a church that's very similar. And the difference between the two? Well, one is slightly cooler. Although whose definition of cool seems to vary, Haddon posted a thing on Facebook. The definition pretty much sounds like CPC is the new cool. We didn't do that on purpose, but we'll take it. Ask him to explain. Mission agencies, movements, churches, all seem to come up with, we have discovered, look what we've discovered or rediscovered. And it's something like the Psalms. And you think, well, no, I think people knew about those for a while. That's not a new thing. So the mindset is expand, extend the brand, extend your influence, extend your own name. And there's some, before you think I've got an agenda here, just as bad is another group who are insecure in defending the status quo and don't want someone extending their brand because we don't want to lose our market share. And that is, we don't want the new thing because we want to be able to carry on plodding and we don't want any threat. And you must be able to relate to that. People love to be part of a winning team. We like to be the talk of church circles and we hate to lose the status that we have. But it's not just between mission groups and churches, but within churches, even within a home group or a ministry team doing something together. The way Christians behave to each other, people have observed, can be a disgrace. And the most discouraging thing, of course, is that the world is watching and non-Christians notice. One thing I really enjoy doing, and hopefully this forum thing I mentioned at Costa will involve this sort of thing, but the Guerrilla Christians. So I've been invited to churches or CUs before, and they have people just fire questions at me, or maybe two or three of us. And it's great, and people intrigued what we can answer. But the hardest question that you ever get asked at Guerrilla Christian is, why do Christians behave so badly, if that's the case? Now, to the non-Christian, I want to say, don't judge Christ by Christians. If you think about that, that's just silly. But to Christians, given people do judge Christ by us, pull your finger out. Now, this might be an urban myth. It's one of these things where no one can find the original quote, but it's been attributed to Gandhi. And I think it's fair to say that some things levelled at the church and Christians are not fair or consistent. But Gandhi said, I like your Christ, but not your Christians. Now, of course, by that, what he meant was my idea of Christ, who's remarkably like me. Nonetheless, we take his point. Now, the warning is, given that's how it is, given that's how it's always been, we can be other. But the encouragement is that Christ builds his church despite its builders. And here, what we have in 2 Samuel is divisive generals and sinful people, and it ends with David as king, Israel united and prospering. And everything in these two chapters says that that shouldn't happen. No one in 2 Samuel 2 to 3 comes out good, not even David. Well, Michal comes out, you come out with sympathizing with her. I think she doesn't come out bad. But the passage is framed around Abner and three failures he makes, or at least three failures he makes, but three that will structure us, is a failure by force, a failure by plot, and a failure by negotiation. So the first thing you see is a failure by force. Now, we've seen last week, we saw Abner. And Abner knows, we know from the passage we just read, Abner knows that David is God's choice, and yet he opposes David. And the choice here he's imposing by force, which leads to a civil war, literally. And so what we have is two sides marching out. Now, we find out they have to go back through the Jordan, so we know he's come from the other side of the Jordan over and is towards, Abner is heading towards David. And Joab and Abner and their troops are either side of a pool, and they agree a contest. Now, you remember David and Goliath, and you may have seen this in films. Often when two warring factions come together, they choose a champion to fight the battle. So you don't have to, it saves time and resources to have just two champions fight. And here they choose 12 each in verses 14 to 16 with sort of tragic and comic results. They grab each other by the head and stab each other and they all die, which is odd. And it raises the question, what does God think about this? And it seems at this point, God is not taking sides. And that everyone is to a degree in the wrong. Well, the result is a fierce battle. And we notice who is fighting? Israel. Israel is fighting within their own tribes. Within the church, there's a fight. And Joab is David's general and his two brothers, Abishai and Asahel. They're the sons of Zeruiah, which is interesting because that's a girl's name. That is David's sister. These are David's nephews. And Asahel, we're told, is very fast. And he pursues Abner. Now, Abner, by now, must be quite old. He's probably older than Saul, who is quite a bit older than David. We notice that Jonathan is quite a bit older than David. So Abner must be pretty old. And yet, he is a hardened general, and he's confident that he's going to win in a fight. And he warns Asahel. Now, why would he warn somebody in a battle like this? Well, there's a mixture of reasons. One is respect. They have long-term relations that go back a long way. But I think probably the biggest reason is whoever wins this war, Abner is envisaging he's going to survive, whether he wins or loses. And he will have to work with Joab and his brothers and others. And he wants to be able to look at them in the face. And Asahel, though, is determined. Verse 23, it ends with him impaled on Abner's spear. I think we're meant to notice a few things. One of the things is he's killed by a stomach injury, same as Saul and same as we heard earlier as Abner himself. So these key leaders die from a stomach injury. But we're meant to notice Abner's repeated warnings. So that's unusual. So we need to notice it. He does not want to kill Asahel. In fact, he's not even looking at him when he stabs him. And you notice the bit that it says the spear goes right the way through him and out the back. So some translations word it so that it sounds like he's got the spear and he's turned it like that and he stabs from behind him. Others say he went into the back of his spear. And you think, well, how did that go through him? They used to sharpen the back of their spears so they could stab their spears into the ground for cavalry attacks and things like that. So either way, it goes through him. And the obvious thing, but it's worth stating, the obvious thing is this is a war. And this is what happens in wars. And this is why wars are a great risk and why military leaders calculate the possibility of winning. I think you meant to go into war, you meant to be sure of three times over of winning. So then in verses 25 to 29 is a truce on Abner's. The truce comes at Abner's initiative, but Joab agrees. And it sounds like at this point, it sounds like they're all going to kill each other if it isn't stopped. But afterwards, when they're all marching back, we get a tally. And there are just a few casualties for David, 19 plus Asahel, and many for Abner and Ishbosheth and the house of Saul. And the numbers suggest, and it was stated that way in case we didn't get it, that power is shifting now, and the centre of power is now going over to David. And the scene ends in Hebron, David's capital, but it's Hebron via Bethlehem. So whenever we hear Bethlehem and David, we remember God's promise to David there. So the point of the warning and the encouragement here is the warning, Abner resists God's king and his kingdom, even though he knows better. And of course, we know of non-Christians who do that. Some people aren't Christians out of ignorance or they lack persuasion. But for some, it's against all the evidence that's been given to them. They know it's true. And we think, silly non-Christians. But some Christians do that as well. They're angry with God and there becomes a standoff. But it's like a standoff with a steamroller, isn't it? And you just think, who do you think is going to win this? Only one winner here. What do they think? Why oppose God's will? And why oppose God? But there's an encouragement, or the hint of an encouragement, that it ends with David via Bethlehem. That the outcome is certain because God's promised it. And nothing can stop it. The king will come from Bethlehem and David will rule. And 1,000 years after David, another will come from there. The next failure is a failure by plot. Chapter 3, verses 1 to 11. Now, a couple of things may have struck you when you read it, or struck me as I read it. Verse 1 is about the Civil War. So we're told a couple of things, that it went on for a long time, and that David grew stronger as it went on longer. But the other thing you probably noticed is wives. We've noticed wives already in 1 and 2 Samuel. So wives for David and Abner. So we've noticed this already about him, that we remember that Saul married him off to his daughter Michal. Interesting thing about her, she's the only woman in the Bible who is, we're told, loves a man. We're told she loves David. No other woman is recorded as loving anyone in the Bible. I'm sure they did, but that's the only recorded one. So that's significant. She loved David. More about that in later weeks. And David left her when he fled from Saul. Actually, she helped him escape, didn't she? And he ran away. And we might be struck by the fact he doesn't take her. Maybe they thought it was temporary. But Saul gives her to another. Now, there's no formal divorce proceedings, but he gives her to another. And then we've noticed, as we've gone through, David marries two other women. And we thought, well, that's not right, as we've gone through. So we've known about these two wives and a third, or a first rather, that already existed. And now we find he has six, plus Michal, and we know about Bathsheba, who's going to come along later, and others, and concubines. These are just the six he has in Hebron. And they have sons and daughters, and they're the cause of the problems we're going to hear about in future weeks. They cause problems early in David's reign, later in his reign, and after his death. Now, to us, we look at these six wives and we think, this is an obvious sin. That's because it is. So especially doing 1 Corinthians in the morning and this bit around 5, 6, 7, it's all very obvious, isn't it? Although he didn't have 1 Corinthians, but he had Genesis and Leviticus, he knew this is wrong. Actually, as well as the obvious wrong that we see, and there's no special rules for kings on this. Well, actually, there is a special rule for kings, special laws for kings. Kings are specifically commanded not to take multiple wives and concubines. So, yes, it's a sexual sin, but it's more than that, because they appear to be politically driven. So we notice that one is the daughter of another king, of a foreign king. David here is being worldly. He's not relying on God's promise alone. And we've seen as we've gone through this theme or sub-theme in Samuel of stop helping God. God doesn't need your help. Just don't be pragmatic. Be obedient. Be pragmatic, but within the parameters God's given you. Don't think you know better and can help him. And when we do that, there are consequences, bad consequences. But still, God established his kingdom despite David and despite us. And then Abner is accused of something similar. So in verse 7. Now Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, why have you gone into my father's concubine? It's quite a rude way of putting it. Now, funny enough here, the baddie is not doing what the goodie is doing. David is doing something wrong. It would appear Abner is not. So verse 6, we've already heard that as David is growing in power, Abner is growing in power in the house of Saul. And Abner takes offense to Ishbosheth in verse 8. He's been fighting for him and for Saul's house and for his friends and family. He's been loyal and he's a man of great power. And I think it's likely that he is innocent, because if Abner wanted to, he could take any woman he wanted and Ishbosheth could shake his finger and do nothing about it. He could take Ishbosheth's throne. And one commentator worked out Abner's age and thought he might be a bit old for that sort of thing anyway. But this point is, there's nothing that Ishbosheth could have done about it. If Abner wanted to do it, he would have done it. It seems that actually he was innocent of this. And the reason why this is a sensitive issue is because taking a concubine of Saul's is a political thing. At least it would have been taken that way. Whatever reason he would have had for doing it, it would have been taken politically. Because it's saying, you can't look after your women, you can't look after your nation. And so invading kings often would take the defeated king's wives and concubines. Sons often inherited the concubines and sometimes the wives of their fathers. Often it would just be to take responsibility of them. They're not expected to have any kind of relationship, but they would sort of take them into their home and care for them. So it's quite an accusation that Ishbosheth makes of Abner. And it just seems that he's paranoid. He knows that power is going away from him, but this man, Abner, stood by him. And so he's paranoid, and his paranoia isolates him. And Abner feels he has to now transfer sides. He's kept David at bay from Ish-bosheth, and now he's going to go over to David. Do you see what he's done? He's made the right choice, but for the wrong reasons. He's not persuaded by God's choice, although he knows it, or David's qualities, but dissatisfaction with Ish-bosheth and his place in the regime. And there have been Abners ever since. In Acts 8, Simon the sorcerer makes a profession of faith, but then he wants to buy the apostles' power. Today, people come to church for what they can get, especially if they can take positions of power, and if they don't get their own way, they go to another church organization or whatever it might be. And there's a warning here, not just for non-Christians. This doesn't just apply that there are non-Christians who do that, but Christians who do that. And the warning of that then gets highlighted and grown in the next section, which is probably the biggest and most significant bit for us, which is verses 12 to 39, failure by negotiation. Now, we've seen some bad politics over the last few weeks on the news globally in various countries, left, right and centre, and here are some bad politics in David's kingdom, or about to be kingdom. David accepts Abner's offer on a condition: bring his first wife, Michal, back. And it seems to be a political move. It could have been romantically driven, but it seems political to cement the divided kingdom, take in Saul's daughter. The two houses are united, especially if there's a child. Ultimately, that fails, as we'll find out. And it's quite a sad scene, isn't it? She loved David. She helped save him and helped him escape. She's left behind, and Saul gave her to another, Paltiel. So she's been used by Saul and David as a pawn. And understandably, her husband, Paltiel, is devastated, and he follows her weeping until eventually he's turned back. And Michal, again, is this just tossed between Saul and David. Later, she questions David's actions, and you hear the resentment in her voice. And David's response to her is scathing, and they have a sort of marriage breakdown. They stay together, but only sort of legally, and there's no children. And David treats her very poorly, at least in the bits that are revealed to us, that we know of. He treats her poorly. And that flags up the fact that we know later on, we get to that bit of the story, David's ultimate downfall is he takes a woman, a married woman, away from her husband. And that points to a contrast. We've seen how David keeps pointing us to Jesus. But isn't he different here? David has many wives, and he pulls them, and there's weeping as he takes one wife to himself. Jesus doesn't have many wives. Jesus has one wife, the church. We are one wife together to him. And when Jesus brings her home, there's rejoicing. There's no sadness. Now, what's interesting here is David asks Abner for her. I don't want to see you until I've seen you with her. But then he sends a messenger to Ish-bosheth, which seems to undermine Abner. Maybe he wants to rub this in Ish-bosheth's face, taking back what's Saul's. But notice what Abner offers in verses 19 to 20. We find Abner going round, talking to the tribal leaders, including that of Benjamin, which is where Saul and Ish-bosheth is from. Some of these are inclining themselves towards David, but it's a bit tricky because of the civil war. Some of them are still loyal to Benjamin and Saul. But Abner goes round, drumming up support for David. He's getting them to change sides if need be, or giving them the confidence if that's what they were thinking. He's doing evangelism, isn't he? Getting them to all come under King David. And I don't know if you noticed as I read it, but three times, quite close together, we had go in peace, go in peace, go in peace. David sends him in peace, he goes in peace, and then we hear he went in peace. So three times, the anointed king, the Christ, sends Abner in peace. Peace means no more war, end of hostilities. So David has made an enemy a friend. And this friend then goes out to more enemies to make those enemies friends. David is bringing Israel together, and he's sending out these envoys to bring Israel together. And the number of those who are under his rule is growing. Those who opposed him are now submitting to his rule. You might think that sounds great, but Joab comes in at this point and is furious, and he does not trust David. He thinks this is another plot of Abner's. In fact, it says that Abner's come to spy on you're going in and you're going out, which is normally a military, about military manoeuvres and plans. Abner's negotiation ultimately fails with David, we've seen, but ultimately fails because of Joab, because he murders him. Abner is naive. Joab calls him aside and stabs him in a gate in the place of judgments where the elders sat and made their judgments. Leaders, in this case David, are only as effective as those that work with and under them. Joab undoes all David's good work. We just think we're getting somewhere with Abner and David, and then this happens. Joab declares himself judge and jury, and it's obviously wrong, isn't it, what he does. But we've got to be clear just how wrong it is. It is cowardly. He's an older man. Joab is David's nephew, so we're talking a few generations apart. Abner had killed Joab's brother. You would understand the emotions going on, but it's in a war. It wasn't cold-blooded, wasn't murder, wasn't manslaughter. He warned him, and if it had been murder or manslaughter, he needs a fair trial under Israel's law. And the irony is he kills him in Hebron. Hebron is a city of refuge. It's a place to stay while your case is being heard. So there are multiple layers of wrong here. But what is his motive? Well, we're told a couple of times it's revenge for his brother. That's the most obvious. But I think there might be more to it in some of the words he uses. But also there's a lack of trust of David. He knows what he's doing. He's in control. Sometimes we have to trust those who make choices and work out whose job is who. We have to do that in our workplace, if we're learning, in a school or somewhere, if we're in a church. You may know better, but you have to sometimes trust someone else who has information you don't yet have. Joab may well keep his job as general, but Abner is a bit older. He's been in charge of a bigger army. He has more experience. Perhaps he'll become chief of staff, minister of defense. You see, after David, there was Abiathar, the priest. He dealt with the religious stuff. And Joab dealt with the military stuff. And they were the two parts of the nation's life, with David in charge of the two of them. Now Joab faces having to share that responsibility, or even come under Abner. Now, we've seen this in politics a lot, haven't we? When there's a changing of the guard in the government or the opposition, there's a clear out, and it's not always taken so well. Joab does not want to share control. Joab has a zeal for David, but it's not matched with his trust for David. And so he helps David and his own anger issues and kills Abner. And in the process, he doesn't help. He undoes all David's diplomacy. Joab, in fact, is a lot more like Abner than he'd like to admit. And quite a lot of us, or perhaps all of us, at least some of the time, have got a bit of them in us as well. Helping but without mutual trust hinders. In church, we work in teams, and the work that the different teams and groups do works across each other. And when we think we're the only one who knows best, and you may feel very strongly about it, trust the others around you. They may be wrong, but that's their problem. It's not yours. Trying to solve things for everyone else actually does not help. Also notice a very important point. The king, the Christ, offers peace. The Christ, David, had given Abner his peace, and then that's been disrupted. If Christ has offered someone peace, you be at peace with them. It's not for you to disrupt. Now, David is fallen, and sometimes he makes poor choices. Although that an important thing is that is not for Joab to say. That's not Joab's place to say whether David made a good or bad choice here. Jesus Christ does not make poor choices. So if someone is at peace with Jesus Christ, you'd better be at that way with them too. A human introduction of division is sinful. And most obviously what happens here is Joab is serving his own agenda to protect his position to get justice. But for justice, we leave that to God. We do have our own agendas, and sometimes we find this thing emotionally hard. I'll give you an example. Many years ago, I was running a group in a church that was very similar to Impact, and the minister didn't consult me, but he took that role from me and gave it to someone else. Now, I had plenty of other things to do, so I wasn't twiddling my thumbs, but I did think, did I do something wrong? Why did that happen? Sometimes new people come to a church and they're enthusiastic, and it causes other people to feel threatened. Don't be. By the same token, don't seek to hold on or to extend your influence. Now, this is where the problems in church start. So in the three failures of Abner we've seen, the first one is a blatant resisting God's revealed will. That's what Abner does. Secondly, for self-seeking purposes. Again, that's Abner. And thirdly, how the negotiations fall apart. We see that with David, Abner, and Joab. The own agenda, lack of trust, I know best, and I need a sense of fulfillment for doing this thing. I like running that. I don't want it to be shared. And it can work on an organisation level, which leads to divisions and arguments and a weak witness, undoing good work and sour grapes. And so the warning in this passage is we can be better. And we must be. This is written to lift our eyes away from ourselves and to a better purpose, because it's not about you. This morning we thought about how you have the big thing and then the smaller thing, but it's closer. This is close, but that's far away. I saw a film recently, Doctor Strange, one of the Marvel films. It's funny, when I ever listen to other people preach, they always have illustrations from Bronte or the Iliad or something, and I give you Star Wars and Marvel. But at the end, this doesn't spoil the film, but at the end he's talking to his guru, and she says, "You haven't learned the most important lesson of all." And he said, "What's that?" And she went, "It's not about you." It's the most profound moment in Marvel. It's not about you. It's not about you or me. And that's the warning. And that's the challenge. And we will all be disappointed and challenged in church again and again and again, over and over. It's not about you. But where's the encouragement? That's the warning. Where's the encouragement? Verse 39, David speaking, "I was gentle today, though anointed king. These men, the sons of Zeruiah, are more severe than I. The Lord repay the evildoer according to his wickedness." So David makes a contrast. There are two kinds of leadership, his and the sons of Zeruiah. The sons of Zeruiah are harsh. David, although he has power, is gentle. So he says, although I'm anointed king, I'm gentle. Or you could translate it, although I am the Christ, I am weak. Be the same words. God's king has power, but he comes in weakness, and he is gentle. So for them back then, despite David's sexual sin and worldly compromises, despite Abner and Joab with their self-serving agendas and mutual lack of trust, despite the whole nation at war and hopeless division and nothing could be done about it, David's throne is established. Now, how could that happen? Just look at the state. But it was God's will and he promised it. Now, the seeds are sown. We've already been seeing that. The seeds are sown that will eventually destroy that kingdom. So multiple wives and their sons and daughters with competing agendas, nepotism towards his nephews and lack of discipline. But David will be established as king over a united kingdom. And his greater son also. But the difference with the greater son is that his kingdom will not be destroyed and doesn't have any seeds of destruction sown in it. So today we see a church globally that is divided and compromised. All sorts of people do that. It happens on small levels. There's a couple of people working on something in a home group, a small little team doing something together, a denomination, mission agencies, all people serving their own agenda under the guise of service to our King. So the challenge is to be honest that we're like it and come under the leadership of the King. but the encouragement. Jesus is building his church. And he says the gates of hell won't prevail, let alone our petty squabbles. He will establish a kingdom. He will establish a kingdom. Despite us, he will establish a kingdom. In fact, amazingly, through all our failings and limitations and sin, he even establishes that kingdom through us. Let's pray. Father, we ask that your kingdom would come through the Lord Jesus, that we would come under and more firmly under his kingship. And we are sorry for the times when we have our own self-interest that we put out there as being what's best for the church or the best in your interest. Please give us the wisdom to be able to tell the difference. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.